Hi, we're back this week with a conclusion of the interview with Joseph Chilton Pierce. His book is The Heart-Mind Matrix. Make that his latest book. And as the foreword was written by Robert Sardello, I'm going to echo his sentiments that Joseph certainly has a way of remaining connected to the source of nurturing while exploring the world. Bravo, Joseph. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Oh, we're back again with, I have to admit, one of my favorite folks I've ever come in contact with. Joseph, you were just telling me about an anthology that's getting written up and how a main thread that runs through all of your work, I would have said your ability to get to the heart, literally, of the matter. And Michael was talking about how absolutely unlimited our possibilities are. So I'm just going to let you fly from here.
Well, yes, that's been one of my things that I've known almost my whole life. I certainly began to discover that in my teens. I found that we're blocked from our potential by our self-limitations. We have an infinite potential blocked by our self-limiting fears and so forth. And that's been one of my major themes in all my books, is this unlimited potential which we possess. It's ours. It's our dominion over this earth, and blocked by our self-imposed limitations. What I would like to do is just mention some of the things that have really caught my attention here lately.
Please.
Yeah, well, for one thing, I was visited by this remarkable guy by the name of Eben Alexander. He's a neurosurgeon. Have you heard of him?
Yes, go for it.
Okay, well, as you know, in his mid-40s, he came down with this dreadful meningitis that kills nearly everybody. He was in a coma, and they somehow or other pulled him out of it. And he had this incredible story to tell of 7 days in paradise. He really can't get over it. He loves to tell that story. He'll tell it at the drop of a hat, anyone who will listen. Because in retelling it, I can tell by watching, he's beginning to experience it all over again. Friend Karen Malik brought him by here one day. I was in a terrible deep slough of despond. I couldn't do much of anything. I was sleeping groggy. She brought him by, and as he started telling me his story, I began to see these tremendous colors coming out, and I knew that I was in the presence of a truly great person, and I'm convinced of that now. And he does love to go around telling his story, because what he has to say is incredibly important, that death is the opening to a whole new ball game. And so it should do away with our fear and our doubt. I got to thinking of our incredible potentials that we are as a human and keep closing our eyes to it. I think of Judith von Halle. You may have heard of her.
Well, yes, I know you wrote about her, about the heart-mind matrix, but why don't you tell us the experience that this gentleman told you, and then we'll move into Judith.
Well, I can't tell you what he told me.
Oh.
It was just the most fantastic afternoon I've ever had just listening to him. He's available. I mean, and I think he's got a book out about it.
Oh, okay.
And there might even be some video clips on it. And he still practices neurosurgery right down here in the hospital in Lynchburg. But at the same time, he knows of this incredible thing that has happened. Judith von Halle was a German architect, came over to New York University to do her PhD, went back to Germany to practice her craft as an architect. She was a follower of Rudolf Steiner. Now, he's one of the great geniuses of the past 6 or 8 centuries. Now, I guess since the great Eckhart, we haven't had anything quite reach the heights of Rudolf Steiner. Fantastic individual. And a terrible bore to try to read, but that's beside the point. But she was a follower of Rudolf Steiner, went back to practice her craft, and all of a sudden, she came down with stigmata. Now, the stigmata happened to Francis of Assisi, the first one that we know in history, 10 centuries ago, and it's where the wounds of the crucifixion began to appear on your body. And Judith von Halle had this happen. It just blew her out of orbit, right in her own life, that was. Now, simultaneously with that, she began to experience the crucifixion visibly right in front of her and take part in it. And the most interesting to me of all, to tell you the truth, is that from that point on, Judith von Halle could not tolerate food. Food reacted to her in her system like some violent poison. And to this day, almost 10 years later, she has not had a bite of food. My friends, the Sardellas, went over just to be in her presence there in Berlin. She's still right there practicing her craft. They sent me back snapshots that they have made of her. And I tell you, she's the most ethereal, beautiful creature that I've ever seen. Of course, it's just a picture I've seen. I would love to have been in her presence. But the most interesting thing is she experiences the model, then she's experienced the whole crucifixion thing in kind of a different modality altogether, in which she's both the victim and a witness and onlooker and so on. Sardella's got a lot of kind of theories about it. But my whole point of it is that she has since that time been in a totally different space than any of the rest of us.
And she's really transcending physical constraints.
Oh, indeed. All that is just doesn't touch her. So here we have, who are we and what are our capacities? Well, they're just so huge and limited by our self-doubt.
Joseph, as you do bring out in the Heart-Mind Matrix, as a child, going back to when someone is a toddler, as you mentioned, they are, on the one hand, they're programmed to go and explore, but they're also programmed still to hang on to whoever their caretaker is, a mother, father, whoever is there. And so to be going out and exploring and then be told no, because the adult knows if you fall off the cliff, that's not going to be very pretty. So being in a body kind of makes all of this from the get-go a tricky path to follow.
Oh, indeed it is. I've written about this in, I think, maybe a couple of my books, because I think the way in which we bring our children into the world and what happens to them after that determines their fate to such a tragic extent. And, of course, what I've always been championing is a totally, completely different approach to bringing our children into the world, including the birth process itself. All that has been one of the things I've worked on. I'm thinking of Baalbek, and I've just recently dug out all my stuff on Baalbek, which blows my mind every time I read about it. In fact, we have lots of photographs of the final ruins of Baalbek. That's B-A-A-L, maybe you say Baalbek. It's in Lebanon. And the thing about Baalbek, we know it was at least 20,000 years ago, 20 centuries ago, that Baalbek was formed. And it was formed of these incredibly huge stones. Now, some of these stones, I think the big one they call the Mother Stone, is about 60 feet by 14 by 12 and so on and so forth. And British engineers looking at it said it would take the force of at least 40,000 adult males to budge one of those stones. And here they had moved them over quite a distance from the quarry to the actual structure itself. And on that, the ruins of that actual structure, which are huge stones, they've built all sorts of other structures in Roman times. And so the issue was, who were the humans at that time that could pull that kind of a stunt and move those incredible stone great distances? Not only that, they found the stone were always cut perfectly out of the mountainside. They weren't cut and then shaped and polished up or anything, they came that way right out of the mountainside. One of the greatest of those is still there. They also came across the only few skeletons they've ever with some of those sites, and they were of males about 7 feet tall, females about 6 feet tall, with perfectly round heads. And that's the only clue so far that we've come across of what these creatures could have been. It's obvious to anybody that they moved those huge stones by levitation, that's part of the human capacity. But we can certainly realize that we have inherent within our genes and tradition and everything else as humans on this earth unlimited potential, what we can easily call dominion over the earth.
Yes, and there is such a resonance that carries in energy fields. I know many folks that are listening today are on board with genetics being only a blueprint instead of being a given and a dictator of what will be. And that's the physical. Darwin spoke about cultural habits turning into species-wide effects, which is what we're living with today. And I'm wondering if you could share some of what you know about the nature of these energy fields.
What we mean by an energy field, they talk about the Akashic Records. That was always considered kind of an occultic notion. But the Akashic Record, and now it's being written up by two or three really top-notch scientists. Loy, I think, has done one of the best jobs with that. The Akashic Record is supposedly the state in which everything that ever was or will be is now. The Akashic Record leads us to the real discovery of duration. And in duration, everything that has ever been is. And within that field effect, anything that ever was is right there always. Anything we're doing moment by moment is always there, but it's in a different state. I've given a lot of examples of duration, particularly, I believe, in that last book of mine, starting with Mozart.
Give us an example of what you mean with Mozart and duration.
Oh, I love that example about Mozart. When Mozart was in his final greatest creative period, he would get a commission for a new work. He would always accept the commission gladly because he needed the money. He was always broke. But he wouldn't have time to do it. He said, I'll let you know when I can get around to it. And he would just stick the commission in the back of his mind as something he had to do and forget about it. And nearly always, and more as he grew older, all of a sudden, in front of him, he would experience, directly in front of him, a round volume of sound in which every tiny nuance and bit of that symphony or whatever it be is there in perfect, purest, pristine form that the human can imagine, all happening in one split second. We get from that into all of the work on many of the discoveries that have been made in the sciences. We look at Auguste Kekulé and how he came across the benzene ring and all these things. They happen in this sudden appearance right in front of them of the issue they're talking about. It only happens for a fraction of a second. And then they have the problem of translating that into the language of their particular discipline. Mozart said, nobody knows how hard I have to work to transcribe down in pen and ink onto paper the thousands upon thousands of squiggles that it takes to translate that which I saw in a split second. I loved that description. And in graduate school, I had a professor of aesthetics who was a pianist, a good one, we had to put up with substitutes quite often because he'd be off on concert tours. He told us about one sonata of Mozart's that was the most perfect human creation. He all but worshipped it, and he would talk about it time and again. And the professor said that one day, having idolized this sonata of Mozart's, he worked up the courage to do it in his concert that night. And he said he leaned back right before he started to play, and it appeared before him in a round volume of sound in its most pristine and perfect form that a human can imagine. He said it lasted only a split second and was gone. And he said, I was completely overwhelmed, leaned forward and played that sonata and did the greatest playing I've ever done in my life. And he had never come across that article, but didn't know about it. He thought he was the only one who had had that experience. That exact perfect creative effect is in duration. It's always right there and will always be right there.
Through all time, we have everything going on at once. As a human race, it's becoming more and more known to the common man that we are becoming quite the energetic alchemists. So much is becoming more and more invisible to the eye, as also with science being able to see more and more that used to be invisible to the naked eye, we can now see. And I think that is all building toward our ability to go beyond and to connect in a very much more conscious way to this duration. It's all building our ability to hang with a resonance, so to speak.
I would like to think that we're making great progress. However, in my time, I have, I was in Army Air Corps in World War II, just seen an awful lot of stuff going on, which clearly spells out deterioration, collapse, and so forth at the same time. So we have these two things happening at once. We're destroying the living Earth with everything we have at our disposal. I think strip mining and shaving the tops off all the mountains and so forth to get coal and turning that into something that poisons the Earth, all of this going on at the very same time that we're discovering more and more about who we really are. It seems to me, however, that those discovering this are rather few and far between. I discovered as a teenager that fire, under certain circumstances, fire did not have to burn me and all these various things. But I found also, and I had witnesses every time, but if I wanted to talk about it, I'd see those same friends, and I'd say, but how do you... Well, I find that they just pull the shades down. They were already forgetting it. They were already wiping their minds of it because it was too much of a challenge.
Yes. Bruce Lipton, who's been a guest years ago quite a few times on the show, and he wrote that book, The Biology of Belief. And
yes.
And he said when he was doing research at Stanford, all the researchers were in their little labs or cubicles. They would come out to the commissary for lunch, and so they would all engage in conversation, and he would tell them what he was discovering about the actual cell and biology of belief, so to speak. And he said, yeah, everyone would be in there going, oh my gosh, you're kidding, really? That's great, that's amazing. And then they'd go back to their cubicle and turn right back into their focus of Newtonian physics. What we do hold that is elusive now will become more and more a force in our field. So maybe we don't need 100 people. There's a myth of a man, Jesus, who came along some time ago, and the fact that his story has carried on for so long, there must have been some element of truth going on in the story.
To my way of thinking, and I've talked about this a great deal, the greatest part of that story is he gave the nucleus for myth. our great mythologies are not built on Mickey Mouse characters, but at the bottom of them all, you'll find a truly great being. And I've been saying for a long time that the myth around Jesus is where that figure has taken its great strength. We've mythologized it, and in mythologizing it, we give it permanence and a target in our mind that we can all then entertain and build on. And to my way of thinking, the mythical figure of Jesus is the most powerful single event in human history. Whether there was even a person behind it or not drops off into obscurity, and it doesn't make any difference. The mythology of it, if we entertain it and hold on to it, wow, the things it can do in our life.
Yes, and to quote William Blake, anything capable of being believed in as an image of the truth.
Well, that certainly is something I believe in. Of course, William Blake is one of my great heroes. I will say this right quick, that I somehow or other had gotten myself in a college situation and was on the faculty, and I didn't go beyond ninth grade, if anybody knew the truth of the matter, because I had left home and was on my own. My faculty members, I couldn't keep my mouth shut, and I was always telling them what I really knew to be true about us, and they were always so fearful. They were always worried about their tenure. They said, but look, we've got this incredible capacity. Well, one of them one day came up and put his hand on my shoulder and said, Joe, I hate to tell you this, but we in this faculty have decided that you're hopelessly mad. I loved it, because it's exactly what they said about William Blake. He was hopelessly mad. And I said, well, boy, that puts me in good company. I would hate to be considered hopelessly right by a mad society. It's much better to be considered hopelessly mad.
In your book, The Heart-Mind Matrix, you talk about reification, and the definition of that is to attribute substance or material stuff or thingness to some imaginary wish, think, product of our mind, and basically a creation out of nothing at all, which goes along with anything capable of being believed in is an image of what can be. Certainly, I think we're getting somewhere if there's a word like reification.
Well, David Bohm, a hero of mine, I had talked about reification being also a real danger, that we take some wild-eyed idea of ours and attribute it to something out there and try to make it real. And this is just a very poor way in his whole theory of thinking all about it. This was one of our weaknesses, was this reification business. He was just one of our truly great physicists, a scientist, and a philosopher all at once.
Joseph, since we're in the science mode at the moment, you propose the question of whether DNA is a thing or a process. And I just love that you even bring that up.
Well, the more we find about DNA, the more it's an absolute astonishing, jaw-dropping miracle and unknown. The fact that we didn't even know about it until we invented the electron microscope, because it's much too small to register. So DNA is itself a profound mystery. And of course, it's made of two strands forming a double helix. And mystery of DNA, and where could it have come from? Well, of course, when we're looking at the Earth as a purely physical thing, and everything has to come from a thingness, that's the deadly part of our current making a religion of science, because No, it's the human mind. The human mind is the great creative factor of this whole universe. When we finally got an electron microscope, they could look, and here they found this double helix, and it's in every living cell. That's the whole source of life itself. That is life. What we're really dealing with is a creator that brings all this about. And the danger of saying a creator brings it all about is we will reify. We'll try to concretize the creative process. But this I can promise you, I know, and it's confirmed over and over, both in my own life and everything I read. The creative process that gives rise to this universe is what we've called God, but that's a very small part. And we generally make an awful mishmash of it, terming the little bit we know as God. I think that our discovery of all this stuff in recent times is our begin to discover the utter awesomeness of creation itself.
Yes, I mean, right now we're talking about the DNA and there's two strands. Well, what if we get another kind of microscope? Who knows what's going to show itself from those two strands?
Well, that's a pretty good point. But the whole thing of it is, I look at our whole discovery of the awesomeness of the creative process itself and what it brings about. And that also that is us. We are that. There are no divisions in this creative process. Susan Langer said, one of the greatest fears we have is of a collapse into chaos should our ideation fail us. Now, our ideation, she's talking about, is the way we put together our picture of the world. And if anything threatens that, then we get awfully upset. Creator and creation give rise to each other. You can't have one without the other, and you can't have anything without both at once. That's the strange loop effect.
Let's have some final words, Joseph, on the misconceptions of heart and mind. Even from when you wrote The Crack in the Cosmic Egg, the heart is the intelligence and the mind is the intellect.
This is something I discovered in India with my teacher. I was, you know, about 10 years in that ashram in India. And the first thing he said to me, this Mukhananda, he looked at me and he said, out of the clear blue sky, how did he know I would be interested in heart? He said, the heart beating in my chest and the heart beating in your chest are identical. There is only one heart in this world. He said, loads of little egos up in heads bouncing around claiming everything. Only one heart. And that has been my experience. And more critically and poignantly in the last couple of years than ever before in my life. And to discover that there is only one heart, and that out of that single heart is a radiation, a vibration, which instantly forms the whole universe. And that every heart has that, and we all get to share the same universe because there's only one heart. And this sounds like, oh my golly, how much ridiculousness. But that business of there being only one heart and the heart giving rise to the whole universe is what we're beginning to really discover. And I think it's one of the most exciting episodes we know. I started this last book of mine about that very fact.
Joseph Chilton Pierce, his book is The Heart-Mind Matrix. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for our weekly guest notices, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.